The same religion that's capable of hideous acts of destruction can also be capable of moments of healing, of restoration, and of hope.
But educate a girl, and you educate her entire family.
There is a son within every person.
When that anger sets in, write it. Write the letters, but don't send them. You never want to leave concrete proof of insanity.
Around 2000, 2001, some interest in geckos began. Some researchers at Stanford and Berkeley, in collaboration with Jacob Israelichvili here, did some very nice measurements that showed how geckos stick to walls and kind of definitively proved that the main mechanism or the dominant mechanism was actually van der Waals forces. And so over the past few years, lots of researchers, well, lots in gecko standards, maybe like 12 papers in 2005 were written about various ways of sticking, of building these synthetic devices that use that mechanism to build novel adhesives. And our approach is kind of unique, and I will tell you about it today. So how do geckos work? I will just give you a little background on what geckos look like. So this is a gecko. This is a tokay gecko. It's one of the largest geckos. It's about this long. We have one in the lab. Mike owns one, and he brings it around for us to observe sometimes. So if you look at, if you blow up the little pad on the gecko, you'll see that it's a multi-scale hierarchical structure. It's not just nano. It's not just macro. It has all these levels in between. So you can see this is a 10-micron scale bar, and you can see that these are stalks that are on the kind of 10 to 20 micron scale. These are broken up into nanoscale setae, which are on the order of a few hundred nanometers in diameter. And then these branch off, and then on the top of each one of them, there's a little thing which is called a spatula. And it looks like if this is the setal stalk, the spatula is this little flat part at the top. And all of these structures are very important to the gecko, and they allow him to build these to walk very quickly on walls, ceilings, do all sorts of interesting things. So we can do, my background is in MEMS, and more recently in nanoscale fabrication and dynamics. And so we can do a lot of these bridging of these scales. And so our approach, in contrast to that of a lot of other researchers, is in building hierarchical structures that bridge from macro to nano to replicate or use the best features of the gecko-inspired system. Some of the applications involve most of the funding that we've had from this project so far, which is where we've concentrated our applications, comes in things like mini and micro robotics, the abilities for walk on walls. These are pictures from Mark Kukotsky's lab. Mark is at Stanford, and he's built some animal-inspired robots, which are very complex. And things like gecko adhesives are needed for the feet of these to enable walking on walls and ceilings. And also, as we scale down, low power reversible adhesives are required to more effectively move around. Other applications involve medical applications, things like drug delivery system, using novel adhesives which will only stick to certain surfaces so that drugs can be delivered in certain locations, things like reversible bandages, things like robotic systems, smart dust, all sorts of interesting applications can be used. So I already told you about the fine hair adhesive motif. It doesn't just is not just used by geckos. I'm just scrolling through all these different insects, lizards. All these things use the same type of mechanism, the van der Waals force mechanism, to stick to things. Even some spiders. But geckos are interesting because they're the biggest one. And so I won't go over the math, but this has been shown to be dominated by van der Waals forces. And the forces caused by contacts, this is just a very simple illustration to demonstrate the fact that if you take one solid surface area, and the force generated on the contact force can be written by this formula. If you break it up, the contact force actually increases by n to the 1/2. So it's more effective for bigger animals to have more nanoscale structures on their feet. And that can be shown. This is a plot from a collaborator of mine, Edward Arts, who's at Max Planck Institute. And he plotted many animals, many insects, many living creatures along versus their mass, versus how many feet pads they have. And so you can see that scales relatively linearly on a log plot. And so you can see that lizards and geckos are up here. They need millions and billions of setae to enable them to stick, whereas some flies only need a few for them to stick. And so, again, we don't have to over-engineer things. We have to be good enough. And so here's the multi-scale conformal structure. And lots of groups have made huge breakthroughs in making beautiful nanoscale structures. And they look great when tested individually by all sorts of different mechanisms. The key here, though, is that when you scale them up and you build a bigger substrate, they don't work anymore. So why don't they work? Well, they don't work because in most cases, they're not conforming to the surface. Geckos stick. Geckos have this lovely structure, which starts with a macroscale leg, and he has toes, and each one of those toes can grab onto things. They can apply friction. They can apply adhesion. They have this structure. And so by just duplicating the nano portion, you're not really addressing the full problem. And so our approach has been to address more of a hierarchical approach to the problem. So if you have a rigid substrate and you build nano, it doesn't really work. You can build a rigid substrate and transform it to micro. You mentioned Spider-Man. This is a toy Spider-Man. This is a paper that came out of a group in Europe a couple of years ago. They took some polymer nanorods, they transferred them to a hard surface, and they jammed this Spider-Man against the wall, and he stuck. He didn't do anything. He stuck. He fell off eventually, and he never stuck again because the force required to push him to the wall was so harsh that it damaged all the nanostructures. So this is a little illustration of some of our initial work. So to create controllable conformance, what we want is a hierarchical structure. So if this is the nano as illustrated here, we have two more levels of flexibility to allow conformation to the surface. And that's essentially what we built. I won't go through the fabrication in detail. I'll just scan through it. This is our initial fabrication was very straightforward silicon level processing. This is just photolithography and etching, deep RIE for those of you who do MEMS processing. And we build these hierarchical structures with a flexible silicon pillar. Diameter and the minimum diameter here is on the order of a micron. It's quite controllable, and then the top platform can be completely controlled too. It's just lithographically defined. So you can get submicron patterning as well. Here's some of our initial structures. Notice that these beams can flex as well as the stalk that they're on, so that creates a lot of conformality. And so these are scalable, so you can build them wafer scale. And those are nice, but those are just the meso and the micro. Now we have to get the nano. So we have to build nanorods. And so nanorods on the gecko. The gecko is of course very sophisticated. Its nanorod, or its little setae, they call them, are about 200 nanometers in diameter. They're 3 to 4 microns long. They are made of beta keratin with a modulus. You'd notice that I have a very large thing, 1 to 15 gigapascals. That's due to the fact that everyone who measures them gets kind of a different number. And the numbers in the literature range from 1 to 15 gigapascals. Maybe they're different geckos, maybe, you know, different measurement techniques. They're ultra-hydrophobic. They don't stick together very easily. That's one of the speculations as to why they're ultra-hydrophobic. They have contact angles on the order of 170 degrees. So our approach to building nanorods was based on this, which was from a publication. Oh, something happened with my text. You can't see the reference. But anyway, this was published in 2000. And this was published by a group who had a very unique approach. So this is a photoresist layer, and they were able to, this is a polymer layer, and they were able to grow nanorods by destabilizing this polymer by applying an AC voltage across it. So we took, except it took a very long time, and the rods were kind of large. So we decided to do the same thing, except we decided to use a plasma and try to speed up this process. So when we use a plasma and apply an AC field, we can destabilize the photoresist layer and both in a combination of growth and etching cause nanorods to form. And so these nanorods are shown here. This is a 10 micron bar. On the next slide I have some dimensions for you. But as you can see, there's a little bit of condensation, but it's not bad. And we're getting nice coverage. And so here's a here's a comparison. This is ours. This is the gecko. these are a little blurry, but this is about 3 microns tall, 3.2 microns. And the diameters range from kind of 150 to 200 microns in diameter. So we thought those were pretty good. The Young's modulus of this material is about 4 gigapascals, so that's right in the or I guess 6 gigapascals for this particular one. That's right in the order that we need. So we feel like we're doing pretty well on this, but again, they weren't ultra hydrophobic. But thankfully, we can do a small coating of them and change them from being hydrophilic, as shown in this picture, to ultra hydrophobic. Not quite as good as the gecko, but pretty good. So then, do these structures work? So we did adhesion testing of these structures, and I'll go through this really quickly because I'd like to get to the reversible aspect and have plenty of time to talk about that. So our initial testing was done with a modified nano indenter. You can see these are these are standard loading curves that you would get from such an object. You get the loading up, the loading down. It, of course, drops below the axis, and that allows you to quantify that adhesion event. And I'll show you our initial results. Snap, there we go. So this is a comparison in adhesion for the three. This is just a polymer on a flat wafer surface. This is just the second bar, is just the nanorods on a hard surface. The third one is the multi-scale structure. And you can see there's a definite increase in each one. But if you look at what the adhesion strength is, it's extremely low. And if you want to compare this to the gecko, it's about two orders of magnitude below the gecko at this point. So we were sort of happy with this, but of course we could do a lot better. This is a durability comparison, which is quite nice to look at because you'd like to do this over and over. If you're going to run on a wall, the structures have to be able to stick and unstick very quickly, and they have to not be damaged. So this is just the nanorods on a surface. You can see that the adhesion goes to basically zero after 5 repetitions, whereas this one stays approximately constant. And if you actually put error bars on here, this trend does not go up. The error bars take care of that. The adhesion isn't getting better with time. And you can also see that on the solid surface, you can see where the nano indenter bead made contact. These are damaged. Whereas on the flexible surface, you can't. The damage is not evident, at least in the kind of cycles we had. So again, how did we do so far? Well, one of the metrics that's been proposed and sort of accepted by the gecko community is this quantity mu, which is the force of adhesion over the force of the preload. This was the spider ram. Extremely, this low fraction means that a huge preload was required to cause sticking. Here's our initial work, and the gecko, of course, being significantly better than that. So we wanted to improve. And we also wanted to look at adhesion control. I like this image because it shows this is an active image of our gecko walking. You can see when he peels off, his toes roll up. And they roll up to optimize the angle of the setae in the surface to minimize the force that it takes for him to detach from the surface. So we'd like to have active structures too. And so we'd want to be able to control them. And so we control them by using magnetic fields. If we build something, instead of building it out of silicon or silicon dioxide, we build it out of a magnetic material, such as nickel. the structure can orient in the magnetic field, and we can get active motion. So this is one of our initial tries at that. This image on the top, it might look like an animation, but it's actually a laser Doppler vibrometer image. It's actually an experimental result. We're measuring the motion of many of the points on that structure under the presence of a magnetic field. So you can see the structure deforms quite well. And these are nickel on silicon platforms. Our second generation, these are again nickel platforms with nanorods on them. We've changed the geometry somewhat to get increased adhesion and increased friction. And so if you compare them to the Gecko, they look quite similar. But again, how do they do? And what do they do? And do we effectively modulate the adhesion? So on these devices, I didn't bring my little demo. I should have. On these devices, you can see that the area for sticking is along here, and there's nanorods on the whole surface. And what happens is if you have that platform here, and you stick it down to something, it creates a significant amount of adhesion. However, if you apply a magnetic field, the platform which was standing like this rotates over. When it rotates over, now something comes down, there's no nanorods. The van der Waals force is very small, and it doesn't stick at all. And you can see that, here's just some arrayed pictures, but you can see that in these two images. So this image is when all the platforms are visible and flat and able to stick. Then you apply the field and they all turn over. Notice you can't see them anymore. They all flip over. Now they don't have sticking. We got some neat images of these. One of the problems is you can't image these in an SEM with a magnetic field on them, right? So what we did was built some that were facing each other, and so when they twist over, they stick to each other. And so then you can see them in their twisted state, stuck to each other, just to get a nice visualization of what's going on, especially this image. You know, you can see them, how they're sticking together when they're rotated. So we tested these with the help of our collaborators at the Max Planck Institute. They had a nice adhesion test setup where you have a large platform, and so you can bring that platform down and test. And here's our results. And so again, this is just the schematic of what's going on in that test. And so this is the device at maximum adhesion. You see the force coming up. There's a significant adhesion force for pull-off. And then when you turn the magnetic field on, the adhesion goes away. And so this is the first step in kind of making active devices for which can peel and unpeel. So here's those adhesion results plotted on a graph. This is with the magnetic field on, so no adhesion. This is when the adhesion is maximized. You can see it levels out over a preload. If you notice, the adhesion force, the pull-off force in micronewtons has gone up significantly over our previous results. And what does that mean for the this metric? We've gone up from 0.125 over an order of magnitude to 1.5. It's over two orders of magnitude higher than anyone else has shown so far in terms of synthetic gecko development. So we're pretty excited about this. And we're going forward. I'll motivate a little bit where we're headed with this. One is to improve the friction concept more. What we've been measuring so far is primarily adhesion. We stick down, we pull off. So there's a little bit of friction adding into that, but it's mostly adhesion. We're developing test mechanisms to both to measure, to quantify the friction. We are also we're also developing devices which utilize friction in various active ways. We have collaborations with industry. We have collaborations with the Army labs on this to develop more active substrates so that we can actually do this peeling event. We're increasing the packing density, which, if you notice, those little platforms were not maximum packing density at all. So we're increasing the packing density, which should cause our adhesive force to go way up. And we're also looking into ways to integrate this. Right now, we have a magnet under the device, but we're also looking at ways to improve the magnetic materials and also integrate the magnetic fields into the single chip. So it's an all-in-one kind of chip-level device. So,
It's easy to get people to be excited about energy because of the importance we have of it in our daily lives. No one can dispute that, and there really is an enormous amount of exciting interest from young people. The problems that we face are probably the most important for the planet that will be here during my generation, certainly, and probably for several others. And it's the students that are here today in the chemical sciences and chemical engineering that will hopefully help solve those problems. They're extremely important. The fact that we use liquid transportation fuels for transportation as the mainstay of our economic viability really is not disputed, and it will likely be that way for a long time. It's not going to change. There's not going to be electric cars tomorrow. The developing world in particular will see an enormous increase in the number of personal transportation vehicles as part of their own development. So this is just a reality, and you can't wish that it's going to go away. And how we meet that reality is extremely important for the rest of the planet. This is just showing that we expect to see in 2050 probably 4 to 5 times the number of vehicles we see today on the planet. So that's going to increase. And sure, they'll hopefully be more efficient, but there's going to need to be means of powering these vehicles. One of the reasons that we currently use gasoline is because it's cheap. It's cheap and it does the job. And it's not really a conspiracy by the oil companies to make gasoline. It's in fact an efficient way of carrying around chemical energy. So we use it for transportation fuel because it burns well in an internal combustion engine. So it's cheap, easy to make from oil. And that's the reason we use it, not because it's something that's conspiratorial in nature. If it wasn't oil, with the carbon-hydrogen bonds of petroleum, we would probably need to use something like coal or natural gas. But all of our energy is somehow based on carbon-hydrogen chemistry, and probably in the future as well, if we use biomass, you'll see there's an enormous number of carbon and hydrogen bonds. So carbon and hydrogen chemistry is really the mainstay of our energy economy, and it's the mainstay of our chemical economy. So these are just things that are going to be important forever, really. The problem with oil is it's going to run out, and we can debate where the peak will occur in production, but it will occur. There's a finite amount. It's not being made anew, and there will be a peak, and the prices will go up as soon as people really grasp that fact. The interesting thing is that there's a lot of gas, and the gas reserves are going up faster than the oil reserves as time goes on. And part of the reason, not the only reason, is that you drill deeper, you get to places that have been hotter in the Earth's crust, and that's where it happens to make gas rather than oil. So as we drill to very deep depths, which people are able to do now with modern technology, we're finding more and more gas, not more and more oil. So that's a real important trend that's going to continue to the future. Worldwide, there's enormous amounts of gas, and a lot of it's underutilized. You know, every time you see an oil platform here in the channel, for example, whenever oil comes up out of the ground, about 10% or so of the carbon comes up as gas. And if it's in a place, unlike Santa Barbara, that doesn't have a market for it, it just gets flared because the greenhouse qualities of natural gas are much worse than CO2. It's flared all over the world. In fact, if you fly over Africa or the Middle East or Russia, you'll see these huge flares accounting for large amounts of natural gas simply being burned. Associated gas, again, associated with oil, is always a common feature of all oil production, and that's handling that is an issue here in the channel, for example. There are two pipelines, one for the oil, one for the gas. That's because we have a market for it. Again, lots of places that there's lots of oil don't have a place to put the gas, and that makes it a problem. In the U.S., about 10% of our natural gas comes from coal bed methane, and so there's always gas associated with coal, especially in China, which has poor quality coal, which hopefully a lot of it won't be used, but it has a lot of gas associated with that coal. And that's another viable source, but these are very small fields. The quantity of gas coming up out of these holes are small, so you wouldn't sustain a very large capital investment. Another source of gas, which is enormous, is far bigger than the natural gas in fields, is in methane hydrates. These solids, they're almost like ice, an ice structure, where they hydrate the methane in a clathrate. These things are kind of amazing, but there's enormous amounts of methane in those, far more than the recoverable fossil fuels that we have. So methane hydrates are something that are important. They've been there. We're trying to figure out ways of getting them out. But that's another source of methane. And interestingly, up in the northern areas, as global warming may or may not occur, these can be liberated, and that puts methane into the atmosphere, which worsens greenhouse warming. So methane hydrates are a big issue. one that's renewable, a source of methane that's renewable, is in biomethane. You can take almost anything, digest it in an anaerobic digester, and get methane. And they do this all over China. Households use just refuse, basically, in a pit, a real simple thing that looks like that, to make gas for home use. And this is very economical. The economics are well known because they don't choose to buy gas. They instead make it at home because they can do it economically. In large-scale units, this can be done even cheaper. And so this would be a source of renewable methane for the longer term. So the problem is what to do with this underutilized research, and what do you do with methane? And the problem is, and it's been historically true in chemistry, is the carbon-hydrogen bond is extremely difficult to manipulate without fully combusting the molecule. And this has been the age-old problem in chemistry. You know, how do you activate a CH bond without making carbon dioxide? And right now we can't really do that, so the first thing they'll do is they'll flare or vent the gas. If it's possible to put it in a pipeline, that would be your choice because it's valuable there. Otherwise, you can generate local electricity by just putting a gas turbine or something on the gas source, or you can re-inject it sometimes into the oil field to help produce more oil. That's not always possible, and sometimes it can hurt the oil field. The more expensive and exotic things you can do with it, you can liquefy it, you can convert it gas to liquids or gas to chemicals, so you do chemical processing. That increases the value of the gas up to very large numbers per million BTU, whereas it's a negative product if you have to flare it or vent it. So this is the technology that's, if you will, up and coming. It costs more money, but you get more value out of the gas. Almost all the gas to liquids and gas to chemicals technologies today were developed by a process that was pioneered by Fischer and Tropsch before World War II, and it involves taking the gas, making synthesis gas, which is carbon monoxide and hydrogen, and then reconverting the carbon monoxide and hydrogen back into linear alkanes that look like diesel fuel. You can alkylate that to make it look like gasoline and branch molecules. You also produce water as a byproduct. This is terribly inefficient from a philosophical point of view because you're taking methane, which is fully reduced carbon, and you're almost fully oxidizing the CO2, just not quite. So it's really, there's something inherently inefficient about that, and it costs a lot of money. Going from here to there is about 60% of the process costs, which are well known because it's been well developed. Nonetheless, people are producing large plants to do these gas to liquid, gas to chemical conversions using Fischer-Tropsch, and happening all over the world, both now and they're planned in the future, because of the price of oil being so high, it makes that viable. The problem is that to justify the billion-dollar price tag for LNG or Fischer-Tropsch-based gas to liquids, you need a pretty big field. If it's a small field, you're not going to go sink $1 billion in capital into that, only to walk away a few years after you exhaust it. There aren't that many of those large fields, and they're all spoken for. There's no more enormous fields to be found. There are thousands of smaller fields, though, where if you can utilize a smaller-scale technology, you can really profit from that. And these aren't being touched by the conventional technology, these small fields. It all goes to the economics of how you deal with oil and gas. Oil is very cheap to refine to gasoline, so the fixed cost of oil refining is almost nothing. So the price of gasoline is really the price of oil. So here it was back at about $25 a barrel back when this paper was written. With gas, the price per carbon atom is very low. It continues to be much lower than oil, but the price of converting it to fuel is very high, so the fixed cost is very high. The capital has always been high for gas conversion technologies. Today, that's still true, though our price at $60 a barrel, we're way out here. The price of the technology has, in fact, gone up for Fischer-Tropsch-type technology, and the gas prices have gotten higher, but they're still much lower on a carbon basis than oil. So the area that we're working in is new chemistry and technology to bring that cost of production of products from gas down lower and lower. Historically, it's been done either by making synthesis gas, which is just applying heat, or alternatively, you can dream of a catalytic approach that takes the methane directly to partial oxidation products. And this has been the dream for a long time, and it still isn't realized, but it's one that we should all be hoping will someday work. Another way to do it is to react the methane with reactive species like halogens primarily, or sulfuric acid, for example, and you can make reactive intermediates that can be then converted into products like methanol. That's still the same approach today. There's also alternatives that are very expensive, like plasma treatment and so forth. So today we use the same basic paradigms, heat, platinum, or halogens, and these are the only ways we really have to convert methane today. again, so with these halogen or reactive intermediate species, the problem is that you frequently have to separate an acid, a water, from your final product, say, for example, methanol, and that's always been the cost inhibiting portion of it. So where GRT, gas reaction technologies, came into play is it grew out of the university. In the chemistry department, Galen Stuckey, Peter Ford, and some students and postdocs were involved with a company that brought the concept and some money, most importantly, to the laboratory. And these guys worked quite diligently exploring a number of things and came up with a core idea that became the foundation of GRT. And this solid reactant approach, which I'll talk about in a second, was protected while they were still in the university. And after getting a Fortune 500 company to buy into the concept and start to fund the work, the company, if you will, really grew, keeping that tie with UCSB, which was very important. And the external validation by having the stuff reproduced in their laboratories was very important and stimulated the students and folks. And we were able to move the facility off campus, and it grew appropriately as our projects grew. Now we have several collaborations with large companies for different chemical products using the same basic idea. So it really was a growth out of an initial seed allotment of funds here at UCSB that, in this case, appeared to be somewhat successful. It's a small twist in what had been done before. You start with the natural gas, the methane, and you brominate it with bromine, so a halogen. And that's done. This is common chemistry. It's not something that we invented. It's done all the time. The next step that was more unique to Santa Barbara was to take these intermediates and react them with a solid that tied up the bromine in the solid state and produced products like dimethyl ether and methanol. The critical thing is getting back the bromine, because bromine's expensive, it's difficult to manage, it has health consequences, so you have to get it all back. And these solids were chosen so you could regenerate them in air or oxygen and bring all the bromine back again to be used. And that's critical, that you are able to reuse the bromine. By tuning the solid, you can switch from one product to another. You can make dimethyl ether and methanol in one solid, but if you change to another solid, you can change the products. And that's really the guts of the intellectual property of GRT, is being able to pick these solids intelligently to tune the product composition and to recover all the bromine. Okay, so I will just talk briefly about how this happens in the laboratory since I have 5 minutes left. It happens just like the picture, actually. In glass tubes at low temperature and low pressure, you can basically put methane, bromine in, and you get out products and then regenerate it in air. It really goes that easily. The devil's, in the details. If you look at the production over time, it's quite stable until you exhaust the solid, which is soaking up the bromine. I won't show you the parallel reactors that we did, but take it from me. The point is that as you change the composition, the product mix changes. So tuning the product mix with the different solids was the key element of the technology. It's a platform that allows you to do both methane, but also ethane, propane, and so forth. All the other alkanes behave more or less the same way, except you have more potential products. And this is a case with some ethane, making ethanol and diethyl ether, as well as ethanol, the aldehydes. So by tuning the solid, you can direct the products from ethane to be a multitude of products, all dependent upon the solid. Now, I won't talk about the ethylene glycol and the epoxides you can also make, but more importantly, draw to your attention, when we looked at solids that were used for making methanol into gasoline and olefins, we saw that we also could make the intermediates into ethylene. So ethylene is the largest produced organic chemical in the world. The mechanism, I won't go into great detail, but it is very similar to making methanol into ethylene over a acid solid. It's bromine and hydroxyl groups are interchangeable chemically, and we saw the same things that people had seen with methanol coupling to gasoline, for example, we can do with methyl bromide coupling to make gasoline and light olefin. So the same product distribution, which was extremely important. So now, rather than just having a reactive solid that drives you to products that are of the same carbon number, you can couple the products to be a multitude of things, including gasoline and aromatics, and then we regenerate the HBr, the bromic hydrobromic acid, with the solid to get back all the bromine. And that's, again, the critical point. So I'm going to skip through these because I'm out of time, but this is just to show we can make aromatic compounds at very high efficiency, and from a single methane molecule we can go through a variety of different potential products. We've demonstrated this is general. We use bromine because that's the active species. It's used in a variety of products, and it can be used relatively safely. The key is this regenerable solid material that goes back and forth from a solid to a different solid, and then is regenerated in air. It's used in a variety of commercial products, and here we care about going from an oxide to, for example, a bromide, and then back and forth and back and forth, and this has to happen many times. I'm going to skip through this because of my time constraints. The idea is that you could, by designing reactors with this kind of solid base, we can use the same paradigm shift that happened with small computers when people thought you had to have giant multi-million dollar mainframes. People think you have to have a giant billion dollar chemical plant, and we see these things as being able to be made very compactly because of the chemistry. And here's just an example of this so-called zone reactor that we built here in Santa Barbara that makes a liquid product that looks very much like gasoline. So the key is making these solids regenerate, and this is just showing what it looks like after regeneration and before regeneration. We've had some stability issues, and I won't talk about those right now, other than to say that it's still a problem. I'll summarize by saying that the hydrogen conversion technologies must be efficient if we're going to use natural gas. This is extremely important now and in the future. The mechanistic conversion of methane using these halogen processes has many analogies to methanol conversion, which we can utilize and we have utilized widely. The challenges remain for us, though, the corrosion resistance. When you have bromine, you have corrosion problems, and you have issues of regenerating the solid. These are things we're dealing with on a day-to-day basis. In the end, it's the economics. You'll use bromine if it's cheaper and not if it's not cheaper. I'll stop there.
So thanks very much. It's a real pleasure to be here. I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of our collective research in the Solid State Lighting and Display Center and in the Materials Department on gallium nitride. And the title of the talk is New Faces of Gallium Nitride. And this is actually a very telling scanning electron micrograph. Normally when we grow gallium nitride, and I'll show you more of this in a moment, normally when we grow gallium nitride, it's a hexagonal crystal structure. And normally what's called the positive C face or the gallium face is straight up. This is work where we've actually literally growing the crystal in a different orientation in what we call the A-plane orientation. And this is selective growth. So this is a small, few micron single crystal of gallium nitride. And what we actually see when we grow it under reasonably natural conditions in the MOCVD growth is actually we don't have what we call a gallium face at all apparent. We have what are called semipolar planes, 101 bar 1 planes, A planes, M planes, and nitrogen face. In fact, it's not clear that everything that Tsuji Nakamura developed, everybody's familiar with the bright blue LEDs, the green LEDs that he invented, the white LEDs, is always on the gallium face of the crystal. It's unclear when we do crystal growth if this is a natural act. And there's some scientific motivation why we go to these other orientations. And this is what I'll try to tell you just a little bit about this morning. To follow up on the theme, and I think you saw this yesterday in Steve Denbar's overview of our lighting center, which is morphing into more broadly into an energy center. And we're not particularly car guys. but as Eric pointed out very nicely in the previous talk, the biggest driver on hydrocarbon consumption, especially imported oil, basically there's a one-to-one conversion of imported oil in this country into gasoline. It's almost exactly a one-to-one conversion. All the imported oil is equivalent to our consumption that goes into gasoline. There are actually a lot of applications in an automobile where we potentially have major energy savings with gallium nitride. One of these is that we're actually looking at photo generation of hydrogen using gallium nitride-based electrochemical cells. So this is what we call solar hydrogen generation via gallium nitride, which has many advantages, potentially major energy savings. And another place in the automobile that we're very seriously looking at is going to gallium nitride-based electron devices, which are basically high-power transistors that we believe very strongly in future generation hybrid cars will replace the silicon-based inverted gate bipolar transistor technology with an enormous 2 to 3-fold improvement in gasoline mileage. This looks completely viable based on materials performance metrics. So our approach to the energy savings in the long term is looking at the solar hydrogen and the GaN-based electron switchings, which we really think has a major chance of getting into hybrid cars. The other place that's very obvious is that in this nation, and in most places in the world, lighting uses anywhere from 10 to 30% of electricity. In this country, it's about 20% of electricity consumption, and where we very confidently, with no ambiguity, feel that we will be within the next year or two even in lab demonstrations is that we will have or incandescent lighting, maybe on the order of a factor of more than a factor of 5, more like a factor of 10 in energy savings, and about factors of 2 to 3 in laboratory demonstrations in solid state lighting. So that's an enormous reduction, and that's absolute pure energy savings. So that's some of our long-term motivation for working in nitrides. On the nonpolar, semipolar nitrogen-faced nitrides, these are some of the people here. I just want to note that the people listed in red, NMOCVD growth of semipolar and nonpolar, and HVPE growth of semipolar and nonpolar nitrides, and nonpolar nitrides are actually posters here. So John, Casey, Troy, Asako, and Mel, and several other people from our group that are working on other aspects of nitrides will have posters here so you can get through the real details. Our groups work with a barrierless collaboration. That's the hallmark of Santa Barbara. So much of our activities is this mafia and other key players between Steve's group, Umesh's group, and my group, to the point that many of the people here are bewildered on who their boss is. And that's nice if you're a boss, because you can either boss more people around or you can defer to another boss. Okay, and so going back to the first point that I talked about, if we look at the wurtzite nitride crystal symmetry, most semiconductors that you deal with, silicon, cubic material, diamond structure, gallium arsenide, very similar to the diamond structure called the zinc blend structure, these are cubic materials. There are many properties that are consequence of their cubic symmetry that are absent, okay, particularly pyroelectricity, piezoelectricity, spontaneous polarization. The wurtzite nitrides have what's called 6mm symmetry. They're hexagonal. These are polar crystals. And so if we look at, and everything here is tetrahedrally bonded. So for example, if this is gallium, it's bonded to 4 nitrogens. The nitrogen's bonded to 4 galliums, just like in gallium arsenide. Or in a diamond structure, everything is in tetrahedral bonding. But we have this unique AB-AB stacking of these closed-packed layers making these materials polar, so that in this hexagonal structure, the positive C-axis is opposite from the negative C-axis. These materials lack inversion symmetry. They are pyroelectric, piezoelectric, polar, non-switchable materials. And this is a unique feature of the nitrides. When the nitrides came onto the scene in the early 90s, it took much of the 90s to understand the polarization effects in the nitrides. And the polarization effects in the nitrides, for those interested in physics, dominate the semiconductor physics, the solid state physics of the material. There was a beautiful convergence that in the early 1990s, David Vanderbilt at Rutgers University proved that spontaneous polarization was a bulk property of polar materials. This has been a long debate in the condensed matter physics community. He developed what's called the quantum theory of polarization. This came on the scene exactly at the same time that the nitrides came on the scene. So it was an interesting convergence of physics and technology at the same time. The consequence in heterostructures is that different materials that we would make, use to make light emitters, for example, and all of the light, for example, in these blue LEDs, they're on the order of 3 to 5 quantum wells of the material indium gallium nitride. That's an alloy of indium on the gallium sites in the wurtzite gallium nitride structure. These layers are about 25 angstroms thick over the wafer width, which is maybe 300 microns. We have about 5 layers like that. So that's a typical LED structure. On one side we inject electrons, on the other side we inject holes. The indium gallium nitride and gallium nitride have differences in spontaneous polarization, and when we coherently strain the indium gallium nitride to match the lattice planes in the gallium nitride, we get additional polarization, which is called piezoelectric polarization. As a consequence, when we have a discontinuity in the polarization, going back to your electrostatics, which we all want to forget, we get fixed sheet charges. These fixed sheet charges are opposite on the two faces, and we get internal electric fields in these materials. What happens in the heterostructures is that these internal electric fields cause separation of the electrons. In the absence of electrons in the valence band states, which are called holes, these separate the carriers. As a consequence of the carriers being spatially separated, the radiative recombination rate is decreased. It's argued that this is a decrease in the efficiency. That's controversial. But what will also happen is that we increase the drive current on an LED, we will always see a blue shift. And so the radiation wavelength is difficult to control. So our belief here, and this is what we started very aggressively about 5 years ago, is that if we can grow in orientations of the gallium nitride where they're inherently no discontinuities in polarization. These are what we call the nonpolar and semipolar orientations. We can actually solve these problems. And so if we look at total polarization discontinuity, either in the important indium gallium nitride on gallium nitride system, this is the materials that we use for the blue light emitters, for the green light emitters, these are the light emitters that drive the phosphors that form the white solutions, or if we look at aluminum gallium nitride, strained gallium nitride, which is the materials that are used in the state-of-the-art transistors, if we, instead of have the material in the C-axis orientation, if we rotate the orientation of the crystal to 90 degrees, crystal symmetry dictates that there's no polarization because we're parallel to the polar axis. So here we should have, in the nonpolar orientations that we work, look very favorable. But also, very interestingly, they're crossing points where in the kind of heterostructures we work on, there's also no polarization discontinuity. So this is the driver for working on orientations that are near here and here, where we have no polarization discontinuity. That's the driver for our semipolar work. The orientations that our planes are parallel to the C-axis is the driver for our nonpolar work. And these are the two orientations that we work on commonly. A-plane gallium nitride, for those of you that took introductory material science and had trouble with four index notation, here it is again to haunt you. This is the 112 bar 0 orientation. And we also work on the M-plane gallium nitride, which is the 11 bar 0 orientation. If we work on planes that are between this C-plane orientation and these vertical planes here, which are the nonpolar planes, so we work in these mixed orientations, these are referred to as the semipolar orientations. Okay. And another big driver, and universally in the lighting game, the early LEDs that were developed and more developed that are red LEDs that you see very commonly and are still the highest efficiency LEDs are in the Allen gap system. And actually, Steve Dunbar's, when he worked at Hewlett-Packard before joining our faculty, was a key player in the development of the high brightness Allen gap system. Those LEDs are very efficient, the external quantum efficiencies. So basically, the external quantum efficiency says for every electron in, how many photons out. And the external quantum efficiencies in those materials can exceed 50%. And in the indium gallium nitride system, if we are in the violet or near UV, we can also get EQEs on the order of 40 to 50%. So things look pretty good in the blue, things look pretty good in the red. And everybody in the field knows this problem as we go towards the green. And the green is where your eye is peaked. Your highest eye sensitivity is in the green. Both coming from the nitride system and from the arsenide phosphide system, it tanks. And it tanks absolutely at the abyss right at green. And in fact, those of us in the field refer to this as the valley of death. Very immature technology compared to the amount of effort that's gone on the right in the Allen gap system or in the InGaN system. Our work at Santa Barbara and then work from Suji's previous company has actually shown, and again, this is at a very primitive stage, that the efficiencies in the green in our semipolar oriented LEDs are already rivaling state-of-the-art highly evolved LEDs in the green on conventional C-axis oriented material. So this is another driver for material. We actually believe that if we can get over this problem of the valley of death here and bring up the green efficiencies either with nonpolar or semipolar orientations or other orientations in the material, that the ultimate efficiency solution for solid state lighting is going to be three LEDs in whatever manifestations that they're packaged and whatever advanced light extraction, because essentially there's going to be no optical pumping of phosphors where there's an inherent loss, and there's inherent loss in extracting light from the phosphors. There's two generations of efficiency losses. We believe that the ultimate efficiencies are going to be RGB solutions if we can get high efficiency green. If not, then the solutions for white lighting will be phosphors. I'm just going to give you a small taste of what we actually do in the materials research. For the nonpolar growth, we do something very, well, unique at Santa Barbara, is that we have large efforts in MBE in my group, and then with CBD in Steve and Suji's group, and HVP in Suji's group. And we just do an incredible amount of mixing and matching. And so we may initiate the growth with MBE in some systems and finish it with HVPE. There's just a lot of mixing and matching and synergy amongst the students. This just lists the kind of systems that we're working at. The two systems are A-plane gallium nitride. These systems are attractive because we grow these on an orientation of sapphire, which is R-plane sapphire. Until recently, R-plane sapphire was the most commonly available orientation of sapphire. And if you have a better watch than mine, your watch will actually have an R-plane sapphire crystal face on it. And the very first gallium nitride that was grown 38 years ago by Paul Maruska working at RCA Laboratories was actually grown on a watch face R-plane sapphire, and you grew A-plane gallium nitride. The very first epitaxial gallium nitride was A-plane gallium nitride. So we work a lot on that system. These other substrates have issues, but we do a lot of work on silicon carbide, which is readily available and expensive. And this is just some idea of the topics that we work on. My ideas for getting into this is that we actually had a visitor from Japan who was making SAW devices, and he had aluminum nitride on R-plane sapphire, and the aluminum nitride films looked terrible, but I realized that he had this A-plane gallium nitride and R-plane sapphire epitaxial relationship, and that was interesting to me because we do a lot of work on C-plane oriented gallium nitride where we might take a seed crystal of gallium nitride, put down a dielectric mask, grow up through the mask material, and grow out laterally. And if the C-axis is oriented this way, and if we have vertical side planes, these planes are nonpolar. And so we actually know very well by controlling the MOCVD reactor conditions. These are systematic growth studies where we're changing gas flows in the reactor. In this case, this is looking at constant temperature and reactor pressure, changing the ammonia source flow and the gallium source flow, trimethyl gallium. And by changing these conditions systematically, we can actually very systematically control this morphology. And so I grabbed one of Steve's students that I co-advised, and Mike Craven, who's at Lumileds, one of the major lighting manufacturers now. I said, Mike, if we grow under vertical sidewall LEO growth conditions, we're going to get planar A-plane gallium nitride. And so that's exactly what Mike did. He developed the growth technology. Much of this is patented now, including both nucleation layer technology and growth technology. And we were actually the first group to realize planar A-plane gallium nitride films by any growth technique. And again, this is on the most commonly available substrate orientation. If we look at the microstructure, my group comes out of materials, and I have to do material science on these materials, so I'm pedigreed in transmission electron microscopy. And if we look in cross-section transmission electron microscopy or plan view transmission electron microscopy first, this is the underlying sapphire substrate. These are several micron thick A-plane films. We see a flat planar free surface. That's nice. What we find in the microstructure is that we have a high defect density of both threading dislocations, and this is at a density that's comparable to the early Nichia, which was the early pioneer in LEDs, the Tsuji LED materials, but we also have basal plane stacking faults, where these are the closed-packed planes of the material and their errors in the stacking sequence. And this has been a problem that's plagued our materials. To reduce this dislocation density, we went to a technique called lateral epitaxial overgrowth, which I already alluded to with the C-plane growth, where we just take a template of material, we put down a dielectric mask, and then what we try to do is grow up through the dielectric mask, not laterally, and hopefully, if everything works well, this dielectric layer here will act as a physical block for extended defects. So we can grow perfect single crystal material out laterally. And at least for university level research, then we can get a real sense of what perfect material would look like for physical properties and devices. Okay? And so, just to show you polarity effects, and again to show you, this is a growth interrupt in lateral epitaxial overgrowth of A-plane gallium nitride on R-plane sapphire. Here's the dielectric mask. The material grows up and out laterally. To show you the polarity effects, this is the gallium face of the material. The positive C-axis of the material is pointing from the right to the left. This is the nitrogen face of the material, and you see this incredible 10-to-1 anisotropy in the growth rate. Okay? And this is something that we see over and over very systematically. These are never one-off experiments. If we look at the microstructure of the material in cross-section transmission electron microscopy, just look at the blow-up here. Oh, this is for the same orientation in the previous scanning electron micrograph. Highly defective material, perfect material here. So we have technologies in hand, at least to address at a local scale, to make perfect material using lateral overgrowth. And we actually put devices down on this material. Since I've been on the theme of LEO, and I showed this view graph from the start, Mike Craven, in his early work, also looked at growth from circular openings instead of stripe openings. And again, if somebody said, why work on nonpolar or semipolar oriented nitrides, is that when we typically grow these materials in circular openings, we see the natural facets of gallium nitride that appear. These planes are inclined, these are semipolar orientations. We don't see any of the gallium face material. And predominantly, for the nonpolar plane that comes out, it's the M plane, and we see nitrogen face. Now, amongst this group, this mafia of Mishra, Denbar, Speck, Nakamura, and others, Tsuji's betting on the semipolar plane. I'm betting on the M plane. All bets are off the A plane. And Umesh is actually focusing on the nitrogen face. So we all have our horses. And the horses actually have different applications. Mine's going to win now. We do actually take these all the way through devices. One thing I advertise, these are early LEDs on planar M-plane substrates. And this just shows something that's very important. When we increase the drive current on these LEDs, we do not see a wavelength shift. If you looked at the increased drive current on C-plane-oriented LEDs, you would see a peak shift to the blue because increased carrier injection into the quantum wells screens the internal field, and then you get closer to the full confined state energy. And so you'll get a blue shift, not a red shift, in the luminescence. Troy Baker should have a poster here. And if we looked at scanning micrographs at other orientations that we work on, the semipolar orientations, they will look identical to these schematics here. So we also have a lot of work going on in semipolar orientations. So just to summarize, we have routes to nonpolar and semipolar nitrides. This is well demonstrated. We have major challenges still in crystal quality. We have routes via these regrowth technologies to reduce the extended defect densities, which at least allow us a window into the future when we can have zero defect density substrates. Mel McLaurin's here. You can chat with him. His poster's on a different topic, but many of the physical properties in the nonpolar nitrides have already set world records, again showing the promise. For early LEDs, both in nonpolar and semi-orientations, we have very respectable early output powers. We still have quite a ways to go to catch up with the C-plane counterparts. Something else that's very exciting, and it's a whole topic of research, is that when we have the LEDs in the nonpolar or semipolar orientations, we break the crystal symmetry and the direct light emission is polarized. And there's enormous interest in this industrially because the basis for liquid crystal displays is polarized light going through the liquid crystal, which is the polarization filter. So we have the possibility of having very high polarized light without any inherent loss, because the way a regular polarizer works in LCD is that you have unpolarized light, you're filtering out all but a little bit of the light, and you just have a huge energy waste for the displays. And I didn't have a chance to talk about nitrogen phase gallium nitride, but this is something that we're very actively looking at. This is being led by Umesh Mishra's group on advanced electron devices.